Chapter 10. The next morning, Colin felt tired enough to sleep through the rooster's squawking until 8. When he made his way downstairs, he found Hollis wearing a pink Mew Mew, passed out on the couch with papers strewn across her chest and the floor. Colin walked softly past her and thought to add Mew Mew to his list, to his mental list of unanagrammable words. Hassan sat in the kitchen, eating oatmeal and scrambled eggs. Without speaking, he handed Colin a note written on stationery, embossed with the words Hollis P. Wells, CEO and President, Gutshot Textile. Boys, I'm probably sleeping, but hopefully you'll get up on time. You'll need to be down at the factory by 9. Ask for Zeke. I listened to your interview with Starnes. It's good work, but I've changed my mind about some things. At 6 hours per person, we'll never get through the whole town. I'd like you to only ask the following 4 questions. Where would you live if you could live anywhere? What would you do for a living if you didn't work for the factory? When did your people come to the country? And what do you think makes Gutshot special? I think that'll move things along nicely. They're expecting you at the factory. Lindsay will accompany you. See you tonight. Hollis. P.S. I'm writing this note at 5:30 a.m, so don't wake me up. Nice bedhead, by the way, Kefir. You look like you stuck your fork in a light socket. Did you know that in 1887, Nikola Tesla's hair stood on end for an entire week after he passed 50,000 volts through his body to prove that Kefir, Hassan said, putting his fork down on his plate. Absolutely, completely not interesting. Now, if Nikola Tesla, or whoever the hell that is, had a long-term love affair with a one-legged chicken and his chicken lust made his hair stand on end, then yes, by all means, share with me this bounty of hilarious history. But not electricity, Kefir. You know me better. Colin searched through the labyrinth of cabinets for a plate, a cup, and some silverware. He scooped eggs from the frying pan onto a plate and poured himself water through the fancy push-this-lever-and-water-comes-out refrigerator. "How are the eggs?" asked Hassan. "Good, dude. Good. You're a good cook." "No shit. That's how Daddy got so fat. By the way, I've decided to start referring to myself exclusively as Daddy. Every time Daddy would otherwise say I or me, Daddy is now going to say Daddy. You like?" "Oh, yes. I love." "Love what?" asked Lindsay Lee Wells as she came into the living room, wearing her paisley pajamas, her brown hair pulled back into a ponytail. Colin noticed she looked different, but not quite how, and then he saw it. No makeup. She looked prettier than she ever had before. Colin always preferred girls without makeup. Colin sneezed, and then noticed that Princess was following in Lindsay's wake. 19 had a dog, too, a miniature dachshund named Fireball Roberts. No one looked more beautiful without makeup than Catherine. She never wore it, and never needed to. God. Her blonde hair in her face when the wind blew as they walked by the lake after school, the corners of her eyes crinkling when he first said, "I love you," the speed and assured softness with which she had replied, "And I love you." All roads led to her. She was the nexus of all the connections his brain had made, the wheel's hub. When Colin looked up, Lindsay was reading the note from Hollis. "Christ, I better get some pants on then," she said. They all piled into the hearse, and after Lindsay successfully called shotgun. At the front door of the Gutshot Textiles, they were met by a large man with a beard like Santa Claus's, but browner. He hugged Lindsay with one arm, saying, "How's my girl?" And she said, "I'm all right. How's my Zeke?" He laughed. He shook Hassan's hand and then Colin's. Zeke walked them past a very loud room, where machines seemed to smack against each other, and into a room with a small brown plastic sign that read the Starnes Wilson break room. Colin put the tape recorder down on a coffee table. The room seemed to have been furnished with stuff that employees could no longer bear to keep in their homes. A stomach bile yellow corduroy couch, a couple of black leather chairs with foam peeking out from innumerable cracks, and a Formica dining room table with 6 chairs. Above 2 vending machines hung a portrait of Elvis Presley that had been painted on velvet. Colin, Lindsay, and Hassan took the couch, and Zeke sat in one of the leather chairs. Before they could even start asking their questions from Hollis, Zeke started talking. Hezekiah Wilson Jones, aged 42, divorced, 2 sons aged 11 and 9, Cody and Kobe, both on the honor roll. I was raised up in Bradford and moved here when I was 13 on account of how my dad lost his gas station in a poker game, which is the kind of shit that happened to my old man regularly. He took a job at the factory. Started working here myself during the summers in high school and went full-time the day after I graduated. Worked here ever since. I've worked the line, I've worked quality control, and now I'm the day shift plant manager. What we do here, boys, is we take cotton, usually from Alabama or Tennessee. He stopped then and reached into his jeans pocket and pulled out an aluminium square. He unwrapped it, popped a square piece of chewing gum into his mouth and started talking again. I quit smoking 11 years ago and still chew this Nicorette, which tastes like shit and ain't cheap either. Don't smoke. Now, the plant. For the next 20 minutes, Zeke walked them through the process of how cotton becomes string and how those strings are then cut by a machine to a length of exactly 2 1/8 inches, and then how those strings are shipped off. A quarter of them, he said, get shipped directly to their biggest client, Starshore Tampons, and the rest go to a warehouse in Memphis, and from there head out to the world of tamponery. Now, I gotta get back to work, but what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna send in some people for 20 minutes for their break, and you can ask them questions. You got any questions for me, by the way? Yes, actually, said Hassan. Where would you live if you could live anywhere? What would you do for a living if you didn't work for the factory? When did your people come to the country? Wait, you already answered that. And what do you think makes Gutshot special? Zeke pulled his bottom lip tight against his teeth, sucking on the Nicorette. I'd live here, he said. If I didn't work for the factory, I'd work for another one, probably. But maybe I'd start a tree-trimming business. My ex-brother-in-law's got one, and he does all right. And what makes it special? Well, shit. For starters, our Coke machine is free. Just push the button, and Coke comes out. They ain't got that at most jobs. Plus, we got ourselves the lovely Miss Lindsay Lee, which most town does not. All right, yo. I've got to get to work. The moment Zeke left, Lindsay stood up. This has been a blast, boys, but I'm going to walk to the store and go stare dreamily into the eyes of my boyfriend. Pick me up at 5:30, okay? And then she was gone. For a girl who'd be in deep shit if Colin or Hassan ratted her out to Hollis, Lindsay seemed quite confident, and that, Colin found himself thinking, must mean that we are friends. Almost by accident, and in 2 days, Colin had made a second ever friend. Over the course of the next 7 hours, Colin and Hassan interviewed 26 people, asking them all the same 4 questions. Colin listened to people who wanted to make a living with chainsaw sculpture or teaching in elementary school. He found it mildly interesting that almost all of the interviewees said that of all the places in the world, they, just like Lindsay Lee Wells, would want to stay in Gutshot. But since Hassan asked most of the questions, Colin was free to focus in on his theorem. He remained convinced that romantic behaviour was basically monotonous and predictable, and that therefore one could write a fairly straightforward formula that would predict the collision course of any 2 people. But he was worried that he might not be enough of a genius to make the connections. He just couldn't imagine a way to correctly predict all the other Catherines without screwing up the ones he'd already gotten down pat. And for some reason, his feared lack of genius made him miss K-19 more than he had since his face was pressed flat against his bedroom carpet. The missing piece in his stomach hurt so much, and eventually he stopped thinking about the theorem and wondered how only something that isn't there can hurt you. At 4:30, a woman walked in and announced she was the last uninterviewed employee of Gutshot Textiles currently at work. She removed a pair of thick gloves, blew her bangs up in the air with a puff of breath, and said, "They say one of you's a genius." "I'm not a genius," Colin said dispassionately. "We're the closest thing I've got, and I've got a question. How come the shower curtain always blows in when the water should be blowing it out?" "That," Hassan acknowledged, "is one of the greatest unsolved mysteries of the human condition." "Actually," Colin said, "I know." Colin smiled. It felt good to be useful again. "No," Hassan said. "Seriously?" "Yeah. What happens is the water spray creates a vortex, kind of like a hurricane. And the center of the vortex, the eye of the hurricane, is a low-pressure area, which sucks the curtain in and up. This guy did a study on it, honestly." "Now that," Hassan said, "is really interesting. It's like there's a little hurricane in every shower." "Exactly." "Wow," said the woman. "I've been wondering that my whole life." "Well, okay. So my name's Catherine Lane. I'm 22, and I've been working here 10 months. Wait, how do you spell that? Hassan asked. KATHERINELAYNE. Uh-oh, mumbled Hassan. She was quite attractive now that Colin took a look at her, but no, Colin didn't like Catherine Lane. And it wasn't the age gap. It was K-19. Colin knew the situation was dire indeed, when he could sit across from a perfectly nice and attractive and sexily older Catherine without even feeling the smallest hint of enchantment. They left after interviewing Catherine Lane. They drove around in Satan's hearse for a while, getting good and lost with the windows rolled down, driving down a two-lane highway towards absolutely nothing. They listened to a country radio station turned up so loud that the twangs of steel guitars were distorted in the hearse's old speakers. When they could catch on to the chorus, they sang loud and off-key and didn't give a shit. It felt so good to sing with those trumped-up hound-dog country accents. Colin felt sad, but it was an exhilarating an infinite sadness, like it connected him to Hassan and to the ridiculous songs, and mostly to her. And Colin was shouting, like strawberry wine, when all of a sudden he turned to Hassan and said, "Wait, stop here." Hassan pulled over onto the gravel shoulder of the road, and Colin hopped out and pulled out his telephone. "What are you doing?" Hassan asked from the driver's seat. "I'm going to walk out into that field until I get cell reception, and I'm going to call her." Hassan began pounding his head rhythmically against the steering wheel. Colin turned away. As he walked out into the field, he heard Hassan shout, "Dingleberries!" Colin kept walking. "Daddy is leaving you here if you take one more step." Colin took one more step, and behind him, he heard the car start. He didn't turn around. He heard the tires spinning in the gravel, and then they caught onto the asphalt. And Colin heard the rumble of the eternally struggling engine grow distant. After 5 minutes of walking, he found a spot where he had okay reception. It was awfully quiet. Chicago only gets this quiet when it snows, he thought. And then he flipped open the phone, pressed the voice button, and said, "Catherine." He said it softly, reverently. 5 rings and then her voicemail. "Hey, it's Catherine," he heard. And in the background, cars rushed by. They'd been walking home together from the radio shack when she recorded the message. "I'm not, and she erred, he remembered, because he'd goosed her butt as she tried to talk. "At my cell phone, I guess. Leave me a message and I'll call you back." He remembered everything about it, and also everything about everything else. Why couldn't he forget? And beep! "Hey, it's Cole. I'm standing in a soybean field outside of Gutshot, Tennessee, which is a long story, and it's hot, okay? I'm standing here, sweating like I had hyperhidrosis, that disease where you sweat a lot. Crap. That's not interesting. But anyway, it's hot, and so I'm thinking about cold to stay cool. And I was remembering about walking through the snow coming back from that ridiculous movie. Do you remember that, Kay? We were on Giddings, and the snow made it so quiet, and I couldn't hear a thing in the world but you. And it was so cold then, and so silent, and I loved you so much. Now it's hot, and dead quiet again, and I love you still." 5 minutes later, he was trudging back when his phone began vibrating. He raced back to the spot with good reception, and breathless, answered. "Did you listen to the message?" he asked immediately. "I don't think I need to," she answered. "I'm sorry, Col, but I think we made a really good decision." And he didn't even care to point out that they hadn't made a decision, because the sound of her voice felt so good. Well, not good, exactly. It felt like the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the fear and the fascination, the great and terrible awe. "Did you tell your mum?" he asked, because her mum had loved him. All mums loved him. "Yeah, she was sad, but she said you always wanted to be attached to my hip, which wasn't healthy." "A better fate than this," he said mostly to himself. He could hear her eyes rolling as she said, "You're probably the only person I've ever known who wants to be a Siamese twin." "Conjoined twin," Colin corrected. "Did you know there is a word for a person who is not a conjoined twin?" "No, what is it? Normal person?" "Singleton," he said. "The word is singleton." And she said, "That's funny, Col. Listen, I really have to go. I've got to pack for camp. Maybe we shouldn't talk until I get back. Just some time away from it would be good for you, I think." And even though he wanted to say, "We're supposed to be friends, remember?" and "What is it? New boyfriend?" and "I love you entirely," he just mumbled, "Just please listen to the message." And then she said, "Okay, bye." And he didn't say anything, because he wasn't going to be the person who ended the conversation, or hung up. And then he heard the deadness in his ear, and it was over. Colin lay down on the dry orange dirt and let the tall grass swallow him up, making him invisible. The sweat pouring down his face was indistinguishable from his tears. He was finally, finally crying. He remembered their arms entangled, their stupid little inside jokes, the way he felt when he would come over to her house after school and see her reading through the window. He missed it all. He thought of being with her in college, having the freedom to sleep over whenever they wanted, both of them at Northwestern together. He missed that, too, and it hadn't even happened. He missed his imagined future. You can love someone so much, he thought, but you can never love people as much as you can miss them. He waited on the side of the road for 20 minutes before Hassan came by, with Lindsay riding shotgun. "You were right," Colin said. "Not a good idea." "Daddy, sorry," Hassan said. "It's a shitty situation. Maybe you had to call her." Lindsay turned around in her seat. "You really love this girl, huh?" And then Colin started crying again, and Lindsay crawled into the back seat and put her arm around him. And Colin's head was up against the side of her head. He tried not to sob much, because the plain fact of the matter is that boy sobbing is exceedingly unattractive. Lindsay said, "Let it out. Let it out." And then Colin said, "But I can't, because if I let it out, it'll sound like a bullfrog's mating call." And then everyone, including Colin, laughed. He worked on the theorem from the time they got home until 11 p.m. Lindsay brought him some kind of chicken taco salad from Taco Hell, but Colin only ate a few bites. Generally, he didn't think all that highly of eating, particularly when he was working. But his work that night came to naught. He couldn't make the theorem work, and he realized that his eureka moment had been a false alarm. Imagining the theorem only required a prodigy, but actually completing it would take a genius. Proving the theorem, in short, required more mattering than Colin brought to the table. "I'm going to burn you," he said out loud to the notebook. "I am going to throw you in the fire." Which was a fine idea, only there was no fire. There don't tend to be a lot of crackling fireplaces during the Tennessee summer, and Colin didn't smoke, so no matches were on hand. He roused about the empty drawers of his adopted desk for matches or a lighter, but he could find nothing. He was hell-bent on burning that goddamn notebook with all his theorizing through, though. So he walked through the bathroom and cracked open the door to Hassan's darkened room. "Dude, do you have a match?" Colin asked, failing at whispering. "Your daddy is sleeping." "I know, but do you have a lighter or a match or something?" "Daddy is trying really fucking hard to think of a non-terrifying reason why you'd wake Daddy up in the middle of the night to ask that fucking question. But no, no. Daddy does not have a match or a lighter, and okay, enough of the daddy shit. Oh, anyway, you'll just have to wait till morning to douse yourself in gasoline and self-immolate. Colin corrected and then pulled the door shut. He walked downstairs and shuffled past Hollis Wells, who was too distracted by all the papers around her and the blaring Home Shopping Network to notice him. Down a hallway, he came to what he believed to be Lindsay's room. He'd never technically seen it, but he'd seen her enter the living room from this approximate side of the house. Also, a light was on. He knocked softly. "Yeah," she said. Lindsay was seated in a plush armchair beneath a giant wall-length bulletin board, on which she thumbtacked pictures of herself and Christina, herself in TOC, herself in camouflage. It was like every single picture of Lindsay Lee Wells ever taken, except, Colin noticed immediately, that they were all pictures from the last couple of years. No baby pictures, no kid pictures, no emo alternative, gothy, screamo, punk synthesis pictures. A four-poster queen-size bed jutted up against the wall opposite in the bulletin board. Notably, the room lacked pink. "It's not so pink in here," Colin commented. "It's the only refuge in the entire house," she said. "Do you have a match?" "Sure," I got a shitload of them, Lindsay answered without looking up. Why? I want to burn this, he said, holding it up. I can't finish my theorem, and so I want to burn it. Lindsay stood up, darted to Colin, and snatched the notebook from his hand. She paged through it for a while. Can't you just throw it away? Colin sighed. Clearly she didn't get it. Well, yeah, I could. But look, if I can't be a genius, and I can't be, I can at least burn my work like one. Look at all the geniuses who either successfully or unsuccessfully tried to burn their papers. Yes, Lindsay said absent-minded, still reading from the notebook. Just look at all of them. Carlyle, Kafka, Virgil. It's hard to imagine better company, really. Yes. Hey, explain this to me, she said, sitting down on the bed and motioning for him to sit next to her. She was reading from a page with an early version of the formula and several inaccurate graphs. The idea is that you take two people and figure out that if they're dumpers or dumpees. You use a scale that goes from -5 for a strong dumpee to +5 for a strong dumper. The difference between these two numbers gives you the variable d, and then by putting d into the formula, you get a graph that predicts the relationship, only he paused, trying to think of a way to put his failure poetically. It doesn't really work. She didn't look up at him, just closed the notebook. You can burn it, she said, but not tonight. I want it for a couple of days. Okay, Colin said, and then he waited for Lindsay to say something more. Finally, she added, it's just a cool-ass way to tell stories. I mean, I hate math, but this is cool. Okay, but soon we burn it, Colin said, his finger in the air, mock emphatic. For sure, yo. Now go to bed before your day gets any worse.